lunchtime at 1 o'clock.
Well, if you've recently tuned in, a very warm welcome to you from me, Jonathan Swain. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. In a couple of minutes, the first of this weekend's early music shows, a profile today of the choral scholar and musician David Woolston, famous from the 1960s onwards for his pioneering recordings of music by Thomas Tallis, Orlando Gibbons, John Shepherd and others, with his group, The Clerks of Oxenford. Catherine Bott talks to Woolston himself in the programme. First, though, at just gone 1 o'clock, a summary of the news. Millions of voters have been going to the polls in Pakistan's general election. Despite a series of gun and bomb attacks by the Taliban, at least 17 people have been killed during the day, bringing the death toll for the whole campaign to about 130. The body which represents family doctors has been explaining why it believes unpaid carers should be screened routinely for signs of depression. The Royal College of General Practitioners has recommended that carers be offered regular doctor's appointments to help maintain their mental health. The retrial of the former president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, has begun in Cairo. The 85-year-old is accused of involvement in the killing of protesters during the uprising which overthrew him in 2011, and also of financial corruption. The hearing was adjourned until next month. A 16-year-old youth has been shot in the back on a housing estate in Luton in the 16th gun-related crime in the town this year. He's now seriously ill in hospital. Police believe the shooting was targeted and are looking for another teenager who was at the scene. Two astronauts from the International Space Station are preparing for an emergency spacewalk this lunchtime to try to fix a chemical leak. Small amounts of ammonia are draining from a cooling system, a situation that could lead to power being shut off to some of the experiments taking place on board. A mural by the graffiti artist Banksy, which was withdrawn from an auction in Florida after protests, has been put up for sale again. The work, called Slave Labour, first appeared on a wall at the side of a Poundland shop in North London last year, but was then mysteriously removed. It was withdrawn from the auction in Miami after complaints from Haringey Council, which said it belonged in the local community, and it's now been listed for sale in London next month. And finally, the weather. After the bright start across some central areas, a band of cloud and persistent rain will move eastwards. It'll become fairly windy behind this, with brief sunny intervals and a mixture of scattered heavy showers. And that's the news and the weather here on BBC Radio 3, with the time coming up to 3 minutes past one. So now, as promised, the early music show with Catherine Bott.
Hello, I'm leaning on a farm gate in the heart of the West Wales countryside. Sheep and lambs to either side, and you can hear them. Go on, do your stuff, sheep. Anyway, take my word for it, they're there. And just out of earshot of the sheep lives the man I've come to see, Professor David Woolston. 52 years ago, he founded a vocal group, the Clerks of Oxenford, whose work can truly be described as pioneering and inspirational. Those two words get a bit overused, but I've chosen them carefully and I think correctly, because today's early music choirs and consorts owe the Clerks and David an incalculable debt. He wouldn't have me say anything of the sort, of course. Now in his mid-70s and winding down a little after a distinguished academic career at the universities of Oxford and Aberystwyth, he includes in his list of who's who recreations Aikido, self-defence, in brackets, instructor, bemoaning the decline of the English language, and he's already said firmly that if I call him a musicologist, he'll be putting his martial arts into action. I shall be watching my intellectual P's and Q's.
Thank you.
the kings of Tarshish and the isles shall bring gifts to the Lord. Regis Tarsis et Insulae by John Shepherd, sung by the Clerks of Oxenford, directed by David Woolston, who's the subject of today's early music show. David, we're sitting in your sitting room, in your house, so I've sort of got you captive. My first question to you has to be, if you don't want me to call you a musicologist, how would you like to be described?
I would not like to be called whatever word you used.
Is it like the Scottish play for actors?
Is it a
word I shouldn't use at all in this room?
I think Sir Thomas Beecham had the right attitude. People who can look at music but can't understand it.
Right.
So I agree with him. No, I'm just simply a musician, and I happen also to be a scholar in various fields.
How did your interest in early music begin? I have to ask you that. This is the early music show.
I wasn't that interested in early music until I came across Harold Walkinshaw, and we had heated arguments about this, that and the other, and I showed him a reconstruction of Gibbons's I Am the Resurrection and the Life, and he said, that's very good. Which part did you reconstruct? And I said, well, actually it was two, and if you can't tell, it's obviously all right. And he said, you ought to go on and do more of this, and so I did. I've been forging, I beg your pardon, reconstructing music ever since.
What about your work on the piece you've mentioned by Orlando Gibbons is I Am the Resurrection. Mm-hmm. We're going to hear it sung by Stile Antico. What's your method of working? Is there a lot of pacing up and down the room, or do you just quietly have some piles of music and a pencil and go to it methodically?
The word methodical is not one in my vocabulary. My father always used to say, a tidy study means a sterile mind. So the answer is, I just do it. I think it's important, I'm not joking now, I think it's important when you're reconstructing somebody's music, not simply to know his style, but actually to be able to get into it and be a composer yourself. I'm not trying to make myself out to be a good composer or great composer, but at least I can compose. I know what composing is about, and it is about not doing things rather than doing things. And same with reconstructing. It's not the possibilities, it's just to say this one is the one he would have chosen.
Oh,
Stile Antico, one of the current generation of ensembles who owe a great deal to the pioneering work of the subject of today's early music show, David Woolston, founder of the Clerks of Oxenford. So, David Woolston, how and when did the Clerks of Oxenford begin?
It was in the 1960s. I'd come up to Oxford quite late because I'd done all sorts of other things beforehand. We decided to have a men's voice ensemble, and so that's how it started. We sang pieces such as Laudem Dicite, which I think we might possibly hear, and did that, I think, for several years. And then a little later, it suddenly occurred to me that if we sang other pieces, they would go off the top because the girls would not be able to sing in the stratosphere.
I suppose I'm stating the obvious here, but it must have been rather revelatory to many of the chaps whom you recruited for the original Clerks.
Well, it was revelatory in that I did pick composers who were then obscure, like Shepherd, who I was very fond of and I was convinced was one of the greatest. The problem was that fate, with its usual insouciance, had left one of his part books behind and no one was prepared to reconstruct those parts. But we sang a lot of Shepherd, yes, and we did make a feature of the male voices. So it was AATB, or in some cases AAT, baritone bass. But the poor old tenors, on the whole, used to have to sing the cantus firmus, so it was quite obvious that Shepherd and other composers didn't think much of tenors.
Could you put into one sentence what a cantus firmus is?
I'm not sure, indeed, that it's the right term, but it's usually nowadays used in modern parlance for a plain chant, which is in longish notes, sometimes very long notes, which is the basis of a longer piece.
Getting back to Laudem Dicite, what do the tenors get to do in that piece?
They are indeed singing the cantus firmus, but the baritones have a lovely time covering them up, singing something different.
Thank you.
Shepherds, laudem dicite Deo, speak praise to our God, all ye who are his saints, with the male voices of the Clerks of Oxenford, directed by David Woolston. David, the Clerks didn't stay all male for too long. You needed women. I mean, doesn't everybody, but why were women voices required?
I realised that a lot of Shepherd was written for a different kind of ensemble, and there were at least two other voices above the altos, the countertenors. And if we sang the pieces at the same pitch as we'd sung pieces like Laudem Dicite, the top voices would go off the stave. And so I scratched my head a good deal, read some contemporary works on the subject, such as Charles Butler's Principles of Music, which was printed in the 1650s, and realised that there were two separate boys' voices, one called a treble and one called a mean, the treble being a very, very high voice and the mean being what we would call a sort of Vienna voice, choir voice. And these very high voices needed to be either boys or ladies who had been gently persuaded by me.
And this is where my other guest on today's early music show comes in. I'm very happy that Sally Dunkley, singer and scholar, very well known in the early music world, has joined us today in Wales. Sally, you were a clerk. Were you persuaded or did you beseech? And when was that?
Well, I came across the Clerks of Oxenford by very good fortune between the time that I had been to Oxford for my interview, hoping to go and be a student there, and the time that I actually went up. I found this tiny little paragraph advertising a concert by a group called the Clerks of Oxenford, and I recognised the name of the director, David Woolston, as the person who had tried to tie me in knots in my entrance interview. So having recognised the name, I went along to the concert, and I was just blown out of my seat with such exciting music making. I was hooked by that stage. Then I later became a student in Oxford, and I remember attending a Clark's concert, and I think the term after that there was a little advert somewhere saying looking for sopranos that can sing high and not wobble. So I went along, and this was a profound part of my life for a long time.
Well, David, it has to be said that back in 1967, the wobble was a sort of prerequisite for sopranos. How did you go about creating the sound that you wanted?
I did have certain difficulties. It took about a year to tutor people into singing in a different way, because, of course, a lot of people have singing lessons, and singing lessons about the worst thing you can have,
dreadful,
apart from elocution lessons. And so I had to uneducate them and get them to sing properly, not to open their mouths, not to lift their heads up like that, and all the rest of it, all the sorts of things you're told at school to do.
Sally, was it a gruelling process being uneducated?
Well, I think I sang most of this music at this particular time on willpower and determination. I had no vocal technique anyway and not very much confidence, but I really, really wanted to sing the music. And for the first year or three, I did try to sing those very high parts. I can't think how, but anyway, there soon were people who could sing those high parts and make it sound easy. And of course, now there are many, many people that have mastered that technique.
And the other point is that it isn't just simply the high voices, it's that each of the voices, the treble, the mean, alto, tenor and bass, they are all focused in exactly the same way. So you get what you might call an ethereal profundity rather than an acutely abysmal sound. This is the whole point of polyphony, particularly when you're, well, say you're doing the 40-part motet. You've got to be able to hear all the voices, and they've all got to be peaking without doing anything by marking the thing saying, sing a lot here. I don't want to do that. All I want to do is to let the composer have his voice. I'm trying to be his executor under his will, and I'm trying to do what he wanted. I don't want to put my personality on the music. I want his personality to come out. And that's all directing is about, I think.
More music by John Shepherd. The Clerks of Oxenford once again singing Libera Nos. Free us, keep us safe, and deal justly with us, O Blessed Trinity. And that comes from a recording made in 1989. Sally Dunkley, you're smiling at the memory of that recording.
I am. Some time back, there was a review of one of the Clark's recordings which spoke of the miracle of the choir master's art. Such a great quote to put on any publicity. And I always feel when I listen to that 1989 recording and I look at the cast list of people that were singing in it, and many of them are different names from the ones that sang in the recordings 15 years before. And yet the sound is so consistent. So it seems to me that David Wolfson's absolutely uncompromising demands of voices were played out in that recording, in that he managed to get people to sing in a particular way that he wanted them to sing. And there's the proof.
Let's talk a little about Shepherd, because his music is so inspiring. Why is it that he is, until recently, less well known than so many of his contemporaries?
Well, he got dealt two duff cards, I think, out of the pack. The first was much of his music is extant in only X minus one part books, so a number of things have to be reconstructed. And secondly, he had the audacity not to be born or to die in any noticeable way so as to have a centenary.
It's also to do with things that happened in the 20th century, because the grand volumes of Tudor church music that were published by the Carnegie Trust in the 1920s and 30s, the volumes of Shepherd were planned, and then the stock market crash, the money disappeared. So it didn't come out in print at that time. And most of Shepherd's music was published in the late 70s, early 80s. And it's unthinkable to me now that a piece like Libera Nos was not known to even a small musical public until relatively recently.
Sally, you studied with David and you've got some very impressive work in the editing field, to your credit, for which you are widely acknowledged. Are there any absolutely inviolable rules that you learnt from David Wolfson?
I learnt a lot about editing and a lot more about copy editing and proofreading from David, because I acted as a sort of apprentice copy editor to one of his volumes of Gibbon's Reconstructed Verse Anthems. That taught me a lot about how carefully you have to go through every score, looking at every symbol.
And David, do you have any inviolable rules? Or is the inviolable rule that there are no rules?
This certainly happened in the case of Praise the Lord, O My Soul by Gibbons. This was one of the peculiar pieces of reconstruction I did. First of all, I had to reconstruct the viol parts and the voice parts. But secondly, unusually, I had to reconstruct the words as well. Because although Praise the Lord, O My Soul, and all that is within me, praise his holy name, is the name of a psalm, he didn't carry on with the same psalm. So I had to chase the rest of the words all around the 150 psalms, and you know how many verses there are in some of them. So anyway, this version is the version I realised in the end was the right one, and I'd got the words wrong in the edition I did. Interestingly enough, the big chorus, Praise the Lord, O My Soul, repeats itself all the way through the piece, except at the end when the chorus changes, and you'll recognise a little bit of, Oh, clap your hands together, all ye people, at the very end. This was obviously composed before, Oh, clap your hands together, all ye people. This is one of Gibbons's only anthems with trebles and means in them.
Praise the Lord, O My Soul, by Orlando Gibbons, performed by the voices and viols of the Clerks of Oxenford, directed by David Woolston. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott. Now we're going to hear a piece by a modern composer, not a Tudor composer, actually D. Woolston. You're setting of Psalm 130, and I think this performance was recorded at your 70th birthday party.
Not the 70th birthday party, the chapel concert which preceded the party, which was past members of the Clerks of Oxenford. And in this particular psalm, I was very pleased that the St. Peter's College choir sang, because they sing in the same sort of manner that the Clerks used to sing, due to the direction of Roger Allen, their music director. And they very kindly sang. It's not exactly a composition, it's more of an Anglican chant, but it does perhaps emphasise another aspect of my work, which is a deep interest in the psalmody of the Bible. And I prefer Anglican chanting to any other forms of psalmody, simply because it sounds to me to reproduce the rhythms of the Hebrew Psalter rather better than many other forms of singing psalms. So this is my setting of Psalm 130, which is a very difficult psalm technically because it has too many syllables in one of the parts, and I solve the problem here by adapting the rhythm of the chant.
Well, I was very honoured to be invited to come along on that occasion, but I couldn't. But Sally, you were indeed there, and I trust singing.
I was indeed, yes. Yes. As soon as I opened my mouth, I was told off. So nothing had changed, really.
It's good to hear that there are things in life that are constant. Marvellous.
Oh,
choir of St Peter's College, Oxford, directed by Roger Allen, in David Woolston's own setting of Psalm 130, recorded at the celebrations for his 70th birthday. Now, we've talked about the scholarly baton that you have passed on, but actually you and Sally have collaborated on several things.
Oh, many.
How does that work between the two of you?
The main thing that we worked on together was Tallis's Mass Pua Natus, which we started working on a very long time ago. Tallis's Mass Pua Natus is in 7 voice parts, and pieces like this do not exist in Tallis's autograph. If only they did, they exist in part books from decades later, sections of which are lost. So in Pua Natus, out of the 7 parts, you have to reconstruct 1 voice in half of the Gloria and in part of the Agnus Dei, and 2 voices in another part of the Agnus Dei. And reconstructing 2 voices out of 7 is actually really hard. So the best bits of that reconstruction are David Woolston's work, some wonderful moments that make me smile every time I hear them. They're so lovely.
Thank you.
the Agnus Dei from Tallis's Christmas Mass on Puer Natus Est Nobis, unto us a boy is born. David, are you conscious of being a pioneer? You started the Clarks in 1961. The last concert was 1989, I think.
No idea. Can't remember.
Nearly 30 years of this group, during which time huge changes in public perception and the amount of public interest in Tudor church music and early music generally. Do you feel, 30 years on from that, do you feel like a pioneer?
Well, it would be nice to feel that one had pioneered in various things, but I just feel it's a job that I have to do, like climbing Everest. Not that I'm going to try.
Because the music of John Shepherd was there.
I thought that needed
an airing.
Mm. Not only Shepherd, many other composers too.
Yes, I took Shepherd to represent the Himalayas, just for today.
My feeling was that at the time that I was singing in the Clarks as a young person, we had a great spirit of an awareness that we were doing something different and something new, different in lots of ways, in that the style, the singing style that the Clarks presented was very different from anything that was going on in a mixed voice choir at that time. Also, when we sang music by Shepherd in particular, you could feel the audience sit up and smile and love it, because we were bringing this really great music to an audience at a time when performances of Shepherd were very, very rare indeed. And also other pieces big pieces by Talis Bird, William Mundy. This music was not in the concert repertoire at that time. And it's one of the things that I'm most pleased about, actually, that in my lifetime, that music has gone from being the preserve of a tiny specialist audience to a really wide audience. I think about it because with the 16, about 3 years ago, we sang Shepherd's great Media Vita, which is a 20-minute piece, which takes some doing, and more than 10,000 people in the UK attended those concerts. I can't believe, you know, when I was a student, that that could ever have been going to come about. And I'm really pleased that it has.
Such a greater number of listeners than would have heard the piece in Shepherd's lifetime.
Of course. Yeah.
I mean, bigger doesn't have to mean better, but in this case, it does, doesn't it?
Yes. And better. I mean, when you think back, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago particularly, or more, would you have dared to programme a 20-minute polyphonic piece to an audience? And I wouldn't have done.
Yes.
So times have changed for the better.
Spem in alium. David, I do hope that it's gratifying for you that Gramophone magazine recently declared the Clarks' recording of Tallis's mighty Spem in alium to be the best. What are your memories of the recording? Where did you do it?
All I can recall is doing it in Merton College, and conducting the thing was bad enough. You see these 40 people, you hear more or less the same chord all the way through. You see the lips opening and shutting, and you wonder, where am I? And I certainly remember coming to the end of a very long session and thinking, I'm completely lost. If I give the last beat, is it going to come on the right one or not? And I just thought to myself, it's going to have to be this one. So I put the downbeat and stopped them, and thank goodness it was the right place.
Thank you.
currently perhaps the best-known 16th century motet in the world. In singer's shorthands, it's Spem, but its full title is Spem in alium nunquam habui praetor in te, Deus Israel. I have never put my trust in anyone but thee, O God of Israel. We're coming to the last music for today, and this is where I want both of you to help me with a quote that I've seen from David. What was the broken glass sound?
It was a way of singing loudly and using a certain amount of nasal resonance. It was particularly characteristic of the altos, and we used to call it the broken glass noise. It's a particular kind of nasal resonance which makes it sound loud, but is not actually pushing. It's, in other words, it's not phonemically pushing. It's just simply the number of frequency ranges that are in the formant.
Sally, has that informed your technique in later years?
No, completely beyond me. I would say that most ensembles of this kind are led by one particular voice part, different in each case. In the Clarks, it was always the altos, the countertenors, who were allowed to sing louder than everybody else and who characteristically sang with what I would call a cut glass sound, a very bright and nasal voice production. You only have to hear a couple of notes to know that it's one of those people. That sound is distinct from that of any other group, I think.
But it wasn't always the broken glass sound. We used that when we were trying to make a particular statement. But in something like In Manus Tuas, which we've heard earlier, we did a different sort of thing and used much more chest resonance to make the sound more hooded and therefore to convey the smell of incense, really, which is a slightly different thing from the broken glass noise.
The smell of incense, broken glass or cut glass, depending on where you're coming from. Now, David, I don't think I'm going to get you to do this. I want Sally to do this. Will you sum up for me why we all owe David Wolfston and the Clarks of Oxenford so much?
The experience of singing in the Clarks, which was shared by lots of us over different generations, and also the experience of studying music with David Wolfston, has left so many of us with a profound love of the music, in particular the polyphonic music of 16th century England. And we've all valued our experience of being inspired by David's love of that music in turn. We've all dealt with it in different ways, I think. I see it now as though he planted the seeds of interest in that music, and we have each worked those out in our different ways. I'm not talking about singing music at the high pitch that he has always propounded. And I don't see that that's really the point. The point to me is about inspirational music making. There is nothing like it. It was wonderful. And it's really interesting to listen to some of these recordings decades later and have that confirmed in so many ways.
It was the friendship between the people and also the fact that they were willing to let the composer say what he had to say. And I was just there to help the composer come forward. We tried not to interpret. We tried just to let the poor old composer have his word.
Well, David Wolfston, you presided over Sally Dunkley's initial Oxford interview, and she got in.
And I've still got the evidence.
You've still got the evidence. Despite that, the two of you are still, several decades later, good friends. Are you happy with Sally's assessment?
Well, I'm embarrassed, I think, rather than
that was the
else.
Aim. Thank you very much, David Wolfston and Sally Dunkley, for joining me today. It's been a most enlightening conversation, and I wish I could say something in Latin at this point.
My pleasure.
Mine too.
concluding pages of Gaude Virgo Christifera by John Shepherd. It was performed there by the Clerks of Oxenford, directed by David Woolston, who was the subject of today's early music show. The presenter was Catherine Bott and the producer Lyndon Jones. And just to add, you can download an edited version of that programme from the Radio 3 website. In tomorrow's programme, Catherine catches up with the work of the group Tonus Peregrinus and their director, Anthony Pitts. That's at the same time tomorrow. Tomorrow lunchtime here on BBC Radio 3 after the 1 o'clock news. Well, back to this afternoon and in a couple of hours, singing of a very different kind.
On BBC Radio 3 from New York, the transcendent conclusion of Richard Wagner's epic Ring Cycle, Goethe Dämmerung, Twilight of the Gods, with set pieces including Siegfried's Rhine Journey and the immolation scene, which are among the greatest moments in all opera. Deborah Voigt is Brunhilde in a live performance from the Metropolitan Opera House. Opera on 3, this afternoon from 4.
It's 2 o'clock, and between now and the Wagner Saturday Classics, today's guest presenter is the pianist Susan Tomes.
For this afternoon, I've chosen some of the recordings that mean something to me. They're mostly of individual artists or chamber music, though there's a bit of orchestral music there too. Maybe because I'm a professional pianist myself, I'm not often drawn to sit down and listen to recordings just for pleasure. Because I spend a lot of time playing the piano, my instinct is to do something completely different, not connected with music, when I'm free. I tend to have music swirling around my head all the time anyway, and I find I practice the piano a lot in my head. So it doesn't often occur to me to relax by putting on a disc. I don't have shelves full of favourite CDs. On the other hand, once I started making recordings myself, I became very aware of how many people cherish their record collections. And of course I've had many reasons to be grateful that recordings reach an enormous audience, a much bigger audience than I could ever reach myself by travelling about playing concerts. So I'm glad that recordings have enabled me to be in touch with a very wide circle of listeners. And despite what I've just said, I do have some favourites. To start with, I've chosen some piano music by Billy Merrill. Billy Merrill was well known in the 1920s as the brilliant young pianist of the Savoy Hotel in London. He composed many virtuoso piano pieces in what he called syncopated style, and I've been playing them for a long time now. I'm often touched by how much pleasure people get from pieces like this. Thank you. That was Billy Merrill's The Jazz Master, played by me, Susan Tomes. Several of my choices this afternoon are of chamber music. That's partly because I've been involved in chamber groups all through my musical life. Being the pianist in a chamber group is fascinating because of the mixture of skills involved. If you play on your own as a soloist, well, obviously you have to be brilliant at it, but there's a limit to how much you're required to take in from outside. In chamber music, on the other hand, you have to be open to the other musicians, always listening to what they're trying to do, as well as sensing how to convey things to them. In the early 1980s, I was part of the chamber group Domus, and we gave concerts in our own portable concert hall, a geodesic dome, which we put up and took down ourselves. It was a lovely thing to behold, a gleaming white dome seating as many as 200 people, and often it did seat 200, sitting on cushions on the grass. Word of our activities spread, and around 1984, we were offered the chance to record something. At the time, we were all obsessed with Fauré's two piano quartets, so we voted for them. It was the first time we'd made a recording, and speaking for myself, it came as a bit of a shock. We had rehearsed and performed the pieces over a long period, of course, but we had never had to play them over and over again at full intensity all day long and without making mistakes. It was exhausting. We each encountered for the first time that terrible moment when you realise you've played something as perfectly as you ever will, but that the producer won't use that passage because someone else made a mistake. This kind of thing makes you aware how tied you are to the others in the group, how you can all hinder as well as help one another. Anyway, we ploughed on for 3 days, and perhaps because of our love of the music and our idealism, and possibly our naivety, our recording came out beautifully.